previously on Unsolved.
I don't understand why you guys keep going all over the place and disturbing.
Oh, so I'm really sorry to disturb you.
No, that's not your place to do that. You went to Lisa's house. You went to her boyfriend's house. Why are you doing this? Because there's nothing.
Well, but there's still a lot of questions involved.
Yeah, but that's...
So we're not trying to... We're not trying to bother anybody.
From USA Today and the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, this is Unsolved Season 4, A Missing Girl, A Search for Truth. I'm Gina Barton. Chapter 7, A DNA Discovery. As I told you back in the very first episode, I started working on this season in early 2020. Then the pandemic hit, and the news business and the world got a little crazy. At the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where I was still working at the time, it was all hands on deck. Everyone shifted away from other projects and toward coverage of the pandemic. I was no exception.
Our country is in the midst of a great national trial, unlike any we have ever faced before. You all see it. You see it probably better than most. We're at war with a deadly virus.
About a year later, as the media started getting back to covering other things, I changed jobs. I was finally able to shift back to this project in 2022. And as I went through my old files, I realized there were some things I hadn't had a chance to follow up on. In the early stages of my reporting 3 years ago, I was following a thread about a woman named Lisa in Ohio whose ex-husband Josh thought she might be Alexis Patterson. Not only did Lisa resemble the age-progressed image of Alexis, she didn't have a birth certificate or any mementos of her past.
Nothing. No infant pictures, no first steps, no pictures in the diaper, no kindergarten, no first grade, no nothing.
Back then, I had talked with Josh's new fiance, Sasha, but I hadn't done enough reporting to figure out how significant some of the things she said might be. I uncovered the recording of the conversation not long after Ashley and I returned from Ohio last summer. First, Sasha and I talked about the at-home DNA test that Ayana, Josh, and Josh's son did to determine whether Ayana was the boy's grandmother. In episode 6, I told you the results were inconclusive. But it turns out there's a larger explanation, and it's important. Sasha and I used the boy's name when we talked, but we're going to beep it here to protect his privacy.
We knew it was going to come back inconclusive because we didn't have the biological mom. Does that make sense? Because we were trying, because Ayana would be Lisa's, a.k.a. Alexis's mom. So to get the conclusive results, we would have needed Lisa and Ayana. But we didn't have Lisa because she's refusing to be or to come forward. So we used Josh and Ayana. And what it did is it came back inconclusive because we didn't have Lisa. But has like 17 matching genetic markers as Ayana.
Sasha sent me the results of that test from a company called Identigene. It does show that Josh's son and Ayana share several genetic markers. And it does characterize the results as inconclusive as to whether or not she's his grandmother. Sasha seemed to think that meant the two of them were most likely related, but I wasn't so sure. To me, inconclusive means you can't tell one way or another. I also thought Sasha could be mistaken about why the test was inconclusive. It seems to me that DNA should be able to show whether Ayana was the grandmother without having DNA directly from Lisa. I sent the results to Allison Peacock, a genetic genealogist we've been working with for our larger project on missing children of color. I found Allison through the work she had done on a case known as the Baby Holly case. Holly Marie Klaus was less than a year old when her parents were murdered in 1981. When the police found their bodies, The baby was nowhere to be found. In June 2022, through Allison's work and that of other experts, Holly was found alive and well and living in Oklahoma. When I told Allison about Alexis's case, she said it reminded her of Holly's. Allison shared the DNA report Sasha gave me with her team. Then she called me back with their interpretation.
They're just saying, basically, on that report that, you know, it's infinitesimally small that a daughter of hers is the mother of this child. And so, but because it's not as low as it could possibly go, they're saying, they're calling it inconclusive. But the difference between what they say conclusive and inconclusive is just noise. It's just static. It's not enough to be significant. So, you know, and I would never suggest that somebody go use a drugstore test to determine. But I mean, when you're a desperate grandmother, I mean, your mother, you do what you got to do. I understand what she did, but I would love to be able to give her some more concrete results based on better testing.
One key element of the better testing she's referring to is, of course, a swab from Lisa, which, after the encounter with the police in Ohio, I can pretty much guarantee we won't be getting. So there was still this sliver of doubt. And as it turns out, we did have some better testing. Sort of. When Josh and Lisa got divorced, both of them submitted their DNA to a family court for paternity testing. Josh's second wife, Sasha, had forgotten all about it until after the Milwaukee police announced in July 2016 that Lisa's DNA didn't match Alexis.
It was quite some time after the July DNA test had came back that it wasn't her, that I was just praying and asking for anything, something to prove that this is not right, like something isn't right. And I woke up at like 4:45 in the morning, and I was like, oh my gosh, the DNA test with Lisa and Josh, that has her DNA on it. So I actually got up and I flipped on the light and I was going through our closet because that's where our safe is and that's where I had everything in there. So I got it out, I sent it to Ayana, and it kind of went from there, and that's how she was like, it's her.
I asked Sasha how they came to that conclusion.
Ayana did a lot of the research into like DNAs and all of that, and then I just asked her, I said, well, can't we just take all the genetic markers, write them down, and compare yours from your DNA test with Alexis, and then match and Lisa's to the genetic markers. And that's how actually we realized that, wow, her DNA is practically identical.
Do you still have, like, the paternity test results that have Lisa's DNA profile on it?
Yes.
Would you please send me that?
Yes.
She emailed me right away, and she was right. When I compared Lisa's results from the paternity test with Ayana's results from the grandparent test, it really did look like the two of them had a lot of matching markers. But because they were two different types of analysis, I couldn't do an apples-to-apples comparison. I needed help from a scientist who could tell me how this all worked and whether Ayana and Sasha had reached the right conclusion. So I sent the grandparent report and the paternity report to Dr. Michael Cox, a biochemistry professor at the University of Wisconsin who studies DNA. First, I asked him about the science behind DNA analysis. He told me that in Britain, in the 1990s, scientists figured out there are tiny pieces of chromosomes that repeat in certain places.
If you go down chromosome 7, for example, there'll be one spot on that chromosome where one of these repeats will occur. And they found examples where they only repeated like between 10 and 30 times in the whole human population.
Okay.
So there wasn't too much variation, but there was a fair amount of variation in the size of that repeat.
Genes come in pairs called alleles.
You inherit alleles from your father and mother. So you get one from dad and one from mom. So on chromosome 7 at this one locus, you might get on one of your chromosomes, you might get a repeat that repeats 12 times. And from your dad, you get another chromosome 7, and you might get one that repeats 17 times from your dad.
As I listened to this explanation, I finally understood what Sasha and I had been missing. Simply having a lot of matching markers doesn't mean two people are related. The important thing is where those matches occur. Two women would need to have the same marker on the same chromosomes, including chromosome 7, in order to be mother and daughter. My heart pounded as I waited for Dr. Cox to tell me whether Ayanna was Lisa's mother.
The answer to that is no. She's very definitely not her mother.
We'll have more after the break.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Every day is filled with so many things we have to do. Work, parenting, supporting our friends, spending time with our families, add chores and errands, and there's not much time left to even think about what you need for yourself, let alone do it. It may seem noble to put yourself last, but it will always catch up with you in the end. When we spend all of our time giving, we're sure to end up burned out and exhausted. Therapy can give you the tools to find balance, so you can keep helping others without leaving yourself behind. A lot of people think therapy is only for times of transition or crisis, but it can also help improve your everyday life. A qualified therapist can help you figure out your priorities, set healthy boundaries, and stop being so hard on yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and designed to fit into your busy schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire about yourself and your goals to be matched with a licensed therapist. You can switch therapists anytime at no additional charge. Find more balance with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/UN today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/UN.
I had absolutely no idea how I was going to break this news to Ayanna. For a few fleeting moments, I thought about how much easier it would be not to. I could just hope she never listened to this show and never found out. I could ask Ashley to tell her so I wouldn't have to. I could scrap this whole project and avoid the entire issue. Obviously, none of those things were realistic. I would have to talk with Ayanna about this eventually. But I decided to take some time to think about the best approach, about how to break it to her in a way that wouldn't destroy her trust yet again. In the meantime, I had another issue to deal with. From the beginning, I knew it would be important to talk to Laurent Bourgeois, who was married to Ayanna at the time of Alexis's disappearance. He had told the police and the public repeatedly that he walked Alexis to the corner on the morning of May 3rd, 2002, and watched the crossing guard take her across the street to the school playground. But the police could never get 100% confirmation of that story. Some students and teachers said they had seen Alexis on the corner with LeBron, or at the playground, or even in school the morning she disappeared. But others were equally convinced she hadn't been in any of those places. The crossing guard was a fifth grader who said she wasn't sure if she had helped Alexis cross the street that morning. And then there were all the theories and pieces of neighborhood gossip that Laurent's history as a snitch, or the fact that he was a drug dealer, may have led to Alexis being kidnapped as some sort of revenge. In the immediate aftermath of Alexis's disappearance, Ayanna backed him up. After they split up, the police questioned her again, hoping she had been covering up for her husband and would finally rat him out. She didn't. The police kept the pressure on Laurent, too. Mark Williams was the prosecutor assigned to Alexis's case. He already knew Laurent from the bank robbery you heard about back in episode 2. The one where Laurent was the getaway driver and testified against a guy who shot a cop. So Mark Williams knew Laurent might talk if he was offered a deal.
I certainly told the detectives that if he would gather and give any information, as long as he wasn't the one that killed her, that we certainly would be willing to, do something for him.
Kathy Spano, one of the cold case detectives who worked the case, said she and her partner, Eric Villarreal, brought up that offer with LaRon.
He was offered that, and Eric and I had spoken to him about that while he was in custody for, you know, for a kind of a serious offense. I don't know if it was a drug offense or what it was when we interviewed him at the jail, but he was certainly told about that. Like you say, he knows. He knows how one man watches the other. He knew that probably more than anybody.
But LaRon didn't tell them anything.
Maybe he didn't agree to that because he was the killer. I don't know. I don't see that.
In January 2020, 2 months before the world shut down, I asked Ayanna if she believed LaRon really had walked Alexis to the corner that morning.
I don't know. I don't trust a soul.
By then, LaRon had a serious drug problem, and the two of them were no longer in touch. They share a daughter, but she didn't know where to find him either. I put LaRon on my list of people to try and track down, but I never got the chance.
LaRon Bourgeois found dead today. The medical examiner says it's being investigated as a possible drug overdose, but an official autopsy is scheduled for tomorrow.
That news was reported on January 19th, 2021. LaRon's death was a huge setback for the investigation into Alexis's disappearance. It was a problem for Ayanna, too, and not just because he was the father of one of her daughters. Without a confession from LaRon, or a lead about whether a rival drug dealer had actually kidnapped Alexis, it seemed that law enforcement would never stop considering Ayanna a suspect. I've come across several indications of this while reporting this story. For example, when Ashley and I were trying to get the Milwaukee police to talk to us about Alexis's case and to release at least some of the records of their investigation, they said they wouldn't, unless Ayanna said it was okay. They wouldn't take our word for it that she was on board. They wanted her to tell the new cold case detective directly. So even though Ayanna was wary of the police, she agreed to speak with the detective, Tim Keller, when I asked her to. She told him it was okay if he spoke with us about Alexis's case. She also told him she did not trust the DNA sample that showed Lisa in Ohio wasn't Alexis, and she asked him to go there and get another one.
Here's what I would say. If, and I'm not saying yet if I'll even get approved to do this, but if I went to Ohio and swabbed Lisa's mouth myself and brought it back here, would you believe that I did it the right way? Or would you accuse me of doing it the wrong way?
No, I want to see it on camera, though.
Okay.
I want to see, if you record it, if I see you record it and I see you tape it up and everything, I see everything,
yep.
Then yeah. But the thing is...
Now, if I do that and I bring it back here and it's not a match, okay, and it's not, will you tell me what really happened?
Are you serious?
If I go through all of that... You're telling me it's going to be a match, so it should be no problem.
Wait, what you mean say you won't really happen? Let's get to that. What you mean say you won't really happen?
Well, if that's not her, if it comes back that it's not her, then there's something else going on.
I also got the impression that the FBI never stopped thinking of Ayanna as a suspect. Back in 2016, after the jurisdictional problems arose with collecting DNA from Lisa in Ohio, and Ayanna started to question whether it had been faked, she called the FBI to see if they would help. Instead of listening to what she had to say, the agent, whose name is Amy Metzel, spent almost the whole conversation trying to get Ayanna to take another polygraph. Ayanna recorded that call, too. She didn't tell Agent Metzel she was recording, but she didn't have to under Wisconsin law.
So if you call the NCMEC right now, and you know the NCMEC, I'm sure you've dealt with them, the National Center for Missing Exploited Children, if you called them, they would tell you, in today's environment, this is one of the things that's automatically done, polygraphs.
Ayanna had the call on speaker and used a handheld recorder, which is why Agent Metzel is so hard to hear. She's saying if Ayanna were to call the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, they would tell her, new polygraphs are automatically done on the parents of long-term missing children. After I heard that tape, I called the National Center for myself. Rebecca Steinbach, who helps lead the media relations team, told me she spoke with several people there, and they don't believe they recommended that Ayanna be given another polygraph. Rebecca also sent me the National Center's Law Enforcement Guide for Investigating Long-Term Missing Children, which says nothing about automatically doing new polygraphs. It says cold case investigators should review the suspect information, which may include polygraph results. It goes on to say that a polygraph result, quote, can be a helpful tool for investigators, but it should not be used by itself to conclusively identify or eliminate a suspect, end quote. And I think it's worth repeating that in Wisconsin, polygraphs are considered so unreliable that they cannot be used in court. Agent Metzel also wouldn't tell Ayanna why they wanted her to take the test again or what they hoped to gain from it. Here's another clip from their conversation.
We would be able to tell you that. I don't think we can give you any paperwork, but at the end of the day, there's nothing that we can do with that.
What is the law for me to say?
Because we checked that box, so if you pass it with flying colors, it's like, okay, we can relax and we don't have to worry about any issues coming up with you. Not that there would be. But I'm so many years now that even if I went to the Milwaukee Police Department and I said, she's elder polygraph, what are they going to do with that?
The FBI agent is telling Ayanna that basically a new polygraph was just a formality. If she passed, she could breathe easy. But if she failed, the police couldn't use the results against her because too much time had gone by. After I listened to this recording, I had some questions. Why would Agent Metzel tell Ayanna that the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children wants to check a box when they told me they don't? If the Milwaukee police really couldn't do anything with the results of a new polygraph test, what was the point of asking Ayanna to take one in the first place? I left a message for Agent Metzel, hoping to ask her those questions, but she didn't call me back. Instead, my call was referred to Leonard Peace, the PR guy in the FBI's Milwaukee office. He told me he couldn't answer any questions.
Number one, we have a very strong policy about privacy rights, and we would never be in a position to make any kind of acknowledgement, positive or negative, just to confirm or deny contact with a private citizen.
I told him I had a recording, so it wasn't about confirming whether the conversation had happened. But I still got nowhere. We had almost a half-hour conversation where I pushed back and he gave me all kinds of examples and reasons and said it didn't matter whether Ayanna was okay with him talking to me. He also wouldn't address what Agent Metzel said on the tape at all. When I asked the Milwaukee Police Chief, Jeffrey Norman, for his reaction to what Detective Keller said, he was a little bit more forthcoming, but still didn't directly answer the question.
I always hope that, you know, we as a department be as professional and as, honest and forthright as possible. But, we have a lot of work to do.
More after the break. It did not make sense that Ayanna would still be talking to me and trying to get publicity on the 20th anniversary of Alexis's disappearance if she had been involved. I asked Gaetan Borders for her thoughts about that. Gaetan is the president and CEO of Peas in Their Pods, a nonprofit that aims to give voice to missing children of color and their families.
And to me, like, for 20 years, she's been, like, engaging the media and nagging the police and even, like, has called the FBI in several different states and gotten meetings with them. Like, if you did something to your own kid, why would you do that?
You wouldn't.
You wouldn't do that. You absolutely would not do that. As a matter of fact, you want it to go away.
Right. Yeah, I mean...
Yeah, you live quietly. You don't engage, like, the heads of departments, law enforcement departments, by any means. So it's harsh. It's harsh.
Kathy Spano, the cold case detective, implied that there might be something more going on.
Are people like that, even some of the other child killers that I've dealt with, and they're in denial because they did such a horrible thing, are they able to... like, totally forget what they did? Are they able to push that out of their mind because it was such an awful, tragic thing? So it was so traumatic that they don't even remember the facts anymore? You know, I got a feeling that is something that could be going on with Ayanna, that maybe she either just doesn't really remember because she was pretty screwed up back then. But I don't know, just something I think about, I guess.
Kathy went on to say that she'd never gotten around to consulting an expert about that possibility before she retired. I knew the perfect person to ask, Elizabeth Loftus, the expert on repressed memories. She's the one who did studies where her team planted memories in test subjects, convincing them they had gotten lost in a mall or been saved from drowning when those things never happened.
Is it possible that you could kill your daughter and then convince yourself you didn't?
Can you erase a memory? And we've tried to erase memories. It's a little bit harder to do. We can substitute one memory for another, and that can weaken the original memory, weaken it. And that maybe is a kind of erasure. But it's a little harder to take a memory away than to plant one in somebody's mind.
By way of example, she said someone could probably convince themselves that they'd crashed after driving through a green light when the light was actually red. But that was a far cry from forgetting an accident had happened at all.
I think it'd be kind of hard to kill someone and then convince yourself that you didn't. Unless you did it when you were incredibly inebriated. I know alcohol and even marijuana can affect the formation of new memories.
The other option, of course, would be that Ayanna really did know something, and she was lying to the police and to Crocker and to me and to everyone. But in my heart of hearts, I just didn't believe that was possible. I have never been the least bit uneasy around Ayanna. She's always come across as genuinely sad and angry about the fact that Alexis disappeared. She's never tried to evade any question I asked. She's always expressed gratitude for all the time I've spent with her and all the efforts I've made to tell her daughter's story. I mentioned that to Dr. Loftus.
And then I guess the other option is that she did do it and she did remember, and she's just been conning me for 3 years. I really feel like I'm a pretty good judge of when people are telling the truth, but if she's actually been lying to me all this time, I feel kind of stupid.
Well, I'll tell you that people are not that great at detecting deception. They use cues that are not diagnostic. They think if somebody, you know, won't make eye contact, that's a sign of, they think if somebody is fidgety, that they're probably deceptive, you know? So you may be responding to cues that lots of people use, but are not particularly good cues as to whether somebody's lying to you.
Just when I started thinking I would never figure any of these things out, I got a call from Ashley Luthern, my reporting partner on this project. After more than 20 years, the police department was finally ready to hand over their files from Alexis's case. And Ashley was on her way over with the first batch. But instead of providing the answers I've been looking for, the police reports would just raise more questions. And they would make me doubt almost everything I thought I knew about this case. That's next time on Unsolved.
This detective then spoke with Ayanna, who at this time became very upset and accused the Milwaukee Police Department of not trying to find her daughter and said that she was sick and tired of what was going on. This detective then explained to Ayanna that we were still actively following up on all leads. Ayanna then got up in a violent manner and with her fists clenched, began knocking over candy throughout the store and then threw a fan into the wall.
Unsolved is written and produced by me, Gina Barton. Ashley Luthern of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel assisted with reporting this season. Our sound engineer is Bill Schultz. Editors are Amy Pyle and Greg Borowski. Our theme music was composed by Evan Johnson. The news clip you heard in this episode came from WISN 12 News in Milwaukee. For more on Alexis's case, or to sign up for our newsletter, visit usatoday.com/unsolved. My team's investigation on disparities in missing children's cases can be found at missing.usatoday.com.